Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's most senior military commander says the Islamic Republic never underestimates threats as he visits an underground base which houses a huge fleet of cutting-edge Iranian drones. Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and other Palestinian factions warn they will retaliate if Israel goes ahead with its controversial flag march in the occupied old city of Al-Quds. Also, the Russian president warns Western arms supply to Ukraine risk further destabilization, while Germany and France urge Vladimir Putin to hold direct talks with his Ukrainian counterpart. Thank you for joining us. Iran's most senior military commander has visited a secret underground army drone base. He says the sky is the limit when it comes to improving the country's drone capability.
The army is enhancing its drone power at a rapid speed. New drones capable of carrying out various missions are being manufactured in Iran. Coupled with the facilities of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, this has created two powerful drone arms for the country.
Major General Bogheri said only samples of Iranian drone power are on display in the underground base, and they just represent the tip of the iceberg of Iranian military prowess. He also noted that the Islamic Republic never underestimates threats and always remain vigilant. The top general got a first-hand account of the Iranian army's cutting-edge capabilities in the development of different types of military combat and long-range drones. Images released show the Kaman 12 drone with a fight endurance of 12 hours. It's capable of carrying four domestically produced bombs and missiles. With this secret base becoming operational, Iran has turned into the top drone power in the region. Geopolitical analyst Hania Tarkian says Iran's considerable advances in drone capabilities highlight the fact that the world's balance of power is changing.
First of all, we have to say that we are witnessing a change in the balance of power in the world. So the world system is going from unipolarity and the American hegemony towards multipolarity. And more countries are trying to reach or keep their independence. And this means that they have to keep military power, and they have to improve and to update their military power. And this is why Iran is showing his military capabilities. Of course, Iran has displayed only parts of its drone capability. There is much more. But this is very important because drones are going to be very significant in modern battles. We have seen this in Ukraine, in the battles in Ukraine. So Iran has to show that his military capabilities are improving, and this is because, as I said, the balance of power in the world is changing.
Palestinian resistance groups warn Israel ahead of the regime's provocative flag march in occupied Al-Quds. Hamas, the Islamic Jihad movement, and other Palestinian groups say they would retaliate if Israel does not change the planned route of the parade and tries to approach Al-Aqsa Mosque. People's Youth Movement in Al-Quds says it wants Sunday to be remembered as Palestinian Flag Day by raising the national flag on every house, square, and street. Israeli groups hold annual event to commemorate the occupation of the Old City and other Palestinian neighborhoods in 1967. A similar rally last year ended with Israeli crackdown and retaliatory rocket attacks by Hamas that led to an 11-day war on Gaza. Regime officials say a series of raids and arrests are expected across the occupied territories ahead of the planned march. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says Israelis have vowed to go ahead with a march in the Old City. They've even threatened to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Here's more.
Well, first of all, there were numerous efforts in order to cancel this Israeli flag march, but it failed. Now, the Palestinian groups and the Hamas movement are demanding the Israeli regime to change the route of the flag march. not to allow the Israeli settlers to enter and march through the narrowest streets of the old town of Al-Quds, the eastern part of Al-Quds, where Palestinians live there, and not to come and read the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, Al-Haram al-Sharif, that is known by the Israelis as the Western Wall area. Up till the moment, there were statements from the Israeli police, the Israeli Knesset members, Israeli lawmakers, of course, are saying that the Hamas threats did not intimidate the Israelis, and they will continue. They will go ahead with the march. Nothing will change. Now, there is this Israeli far-right-wing lawmaker, Ben Gavir. This Israeli settler is well-known for trying every time to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex with a number of Israeli settlers under the protection of Israeli police. This time, he's demanding that he has the right to at least raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex even before the start of the flag march.
The Russian president says Moscow was ready to help find ways to ship grain stuck in Ukrainian ports during the conflict. Vladimir Putin made the announcement in a phone call with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Putin said Russia is also ready to help reduce tensions on the global food market by increasing its export of fertilizers and agricultural products. He said this, however, requires the removal of relevant Western sanctions on Russia. Putin pointed to the Western arms supplies to Ukraine, warning that they risk, quote, further destabilization. He also touched upon stalled diplomatic efforts aimed at ending the war with Ukraine, saying Moscow was ready to resume negotiations. Scholz and Macron asked Putin to hold serious and direct negotiations with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Journalist and geopolitical analyst Fiorella Isabel tells us about the lingering Cold War mentality in the U.S. and the current Russia-Ukraine conflict. Let's take a listen.
The U.S. is obviously being disingenuous. We really never ended the Cold War. The whole reason we're here right now is because NATO and the United States, NATO pushed by the United States and the EU, in great part, crossed Russia's red lines that the United States intelligence and State Department knew that was the expansion of NATO eastward. And also, of course, the failed state that Ukraine was in 2014, something that largely the State Department of the United States wants to ignore, the fact that that people within the region of Donbass were murdered, 14,000 civilians have died in the last 8 years. And so therefore, Ukraine could be considered, as many other states are considered, a neo-colonial state of NATO and the West. And this new Cold War, as you mentioned, also includes China, with the U.S. setting their sights into Taiwan, setting their sights into Eurasia, not being honest and understanding that they're clearly losing this battle, not just militarily. We obviously have NATO troops in Ukraine, but also the battle of the people, even in spite of mainstream media covering the Ukraine-Russia conflict from a very pro-Ukrainian perspective, independent media and others have on the ground have pretty much shown the potency of the Russian forces.
Over 3 months into the Russia-Ukraine war, Russian forces are making advances on Ukrainian strongholds in the east as the battle for the Donbass region intensifies. Let's take a look at the latest developments.
Russian forces and their allies have gained full control of the town of Lyman in the Donetsk region. That's according to the Russian Defense Ministry. The railway hub lies on the road to the key cities of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, which are still under Kiev's control. It is also located 40 kilometers west of the largest Donbass city of Severodonetsk, the current focus of the Russian offensive in the east. Luhansk's governor says Russian troops have entered Severodonetsk. Elsewhere in the south, local authorities say the southwestern Ukrainian port city of Mykolaiv came under Russian shelling on Saturday. The city is 60 kilometers from the Russian-held city of Kherson. Also, according to a regional military governor, Russian forces have pounded the district of the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv.
A stampede at a church in southern Nigeria has left at least 31 people dead. The disaster happened in the city of Port Harcourt in Rivers State. The stampede broke out during a charity event where food was being distributed. The event was organized by the King's Assembly Church. Nigeria has seen several stampede tragedies over food distribution in recent years, including an aid-agency food program in North Borno State, where 7 women were trampled to death last year. The United States has imposed fresh sanctions on North Korea, this one day after Russia and China vetoed a Washington-led push for more U.N. embargoes on the East Asian country over its recent missile launches. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the matter in depth. Let's have a look.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, the United States has hit North Korea with new sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. The U.S. Treasury Department says it has blacklisted 2 Russian banks and a North Korean company and an individual. It said Washington would continue to implement sanctions but urged the North to return to a diplomatic path. The move came a day after China and Russia vetoed a U.S.-led push for more U.N. sanctions over North Korea's missile launches. In a joint statement later, the U.S., Japan, and South Korea strongly condemned the North's recent ballistic missile launches. Talks on Pyongyang's denuclearization have been stalled since a summit with the U.S. collapsed in 2019. North Korea says its nuclear and missile programs are to counter hostile U.S. policies. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent Frank Smith, who's joining us live from Seoul, and also John Stepling, author and commentator. Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with our correspondent, Frank. Is the U.S. policy towards North Korea growing more confrontational, in your opinion?
Well, I think we have to look at the South Korean context to analyze this. Here in South Korea on May 10th, they inaugurated a new president, Yoon Suk-yeol, and he's campaigned upon a promise of strengthening the U.S. alliance. He's also suggested that he wanted to deploy another THAAD battery, that's a terminal high altitude area defense anti-ballistic missile system made by the U.S., costs $1 billion, and it's aimed at, you know, protecting South Korea and can also be reconfigured in terms of its satellite imagery and surveillance into China. So it defends China as well. Yoon Suk-yeol, President Yoon here in South Korea, also wants the military to design a preemptive strike on North Korea should it appear that North Korea is going to launch a missile towards South Korea. South Korea has also purchased tens of billions of dollars of U.S. weapons recently, including 40 Joint Strike Fighter aircraft. So, you know, when we talk about the hostile U.S. policy, we also have to look at the South Korean policy in terms of what Kim Jong-un and North Korea is referring to from the U.S. It's the U.S. support of United Nations Security Council sanctions and the 28,500 U.S. troops stationed here in South Korea. Those are really the things that North Korea is talking about in terms of Washington.
Mr. Stepling, North Korea also seems to be upping the ante in its confrontation with the U.S. We've seen multiple missile launches recently, 3 right after Biden left the region days ago. Why is that?
Well, look, I mean, the U.S. hypocrisy in these matters is jaw-dropping. It always has been. It continues to be. The U.S. tests missiles, you know, weekly. It has military tests and exercises around the world at its 900-plus military bases every day. I mean, so the U.S. exhibits this American exceptionalism and points its finger at North Korea. The North Korean economy has really suffered from sanctions. It suffered from a lockdown due to the COVID pandemic, whether, you know, that kind of lockdown was justified or not. It certainly hurt the economy, and the economy in North Korea shrank for the first time, I think, since 2017. You know, what North Korea did, all of this is operative on a symbolic level, essentially. All they did was test a missile. And there's some question about whether it was really the missile they claimed it to be. But it doesn't matter. North Korea is in a desperate situation. And the U.S. statement is just drenched in hypocrisy. And when they, you know, they say North Korea should return to the negotiating table, it's the U.S. who has refused to negotiate, just like with the Ukraine and Russia conflict. Russia had gone to the U.N., gone to the U.S., asked to negotiate. North Korea has been very amenable to negotiation, but been rebuffed by the U.S. and U.N. And the U.N. is nothing more than a rubber stamp, essentially, for the U.S. So the ascension of a very far right-wing president in South Korea is indeed very telling and bad, and it's another example of this sort of rehabilitated fascism that is taking place globally. This is a guy who ran, as your other guest noted, on a platform that targeted very aggressive actions, targeted North Korea for very aggressive actions, and amped up the rhetoric of threat and fear throughout his campaign. So the U.S. is just, you know, North Korea is not really an issue. It's a sort of back burner issue for the Biden administration. It's not that important, except as it affects the Russia-Ukraine conflict and except as it affects relationships with China. But the U.S., how many countries? There's like eight countries now suffering sanctions from the U.S., and none of them are justified. All of them are taking place in the make-believe world of American exceptionalism.
Okay, that's all the time that we have. John Stepling, author and commentator, our correspondent Frank Smith from Seoul. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Permanent war has cannibalized the U.S. It has created a social, political, and economic morass, says Chris Hedges, journalist, in an article published under the heading, The Permanent War Economy. Stay tuned for more. The United States, as the near-unanimous vote to provide nearly $40 billion in aid to Ukraine illustrates, is trapped in the death spiral of unchecked militarism. No high-speed trains, no universal health care, no viable COVID relief program, no respite from 8.3% inflation. No infrastructure programs to repair decaying roads and bridges, which require $41.8 billion to fix the 43,586 structurally deficient bridges, on average 68 years old. No forgiveness of $1.7 trillion in student debt. No addressing income inequality. No program to feed the 17 million children who go to bed each night hungry. No rational gun control or curbing of the epidemic of nihilistic violence and mass shootings. No help for the 100,000 Americans who die each year of drug overdoses. No minimum wage of $15 an hour to counter 44 years of wage stagnation. No respite from gas prices that are projected to hit $6 a gallon. The permanent war economy implanted since the end of the Second World War has destroyed the private economy, bankrupted the United States, and squandered trillions of dollars of taxpayer money. The monopolization of capital by the military has driven the U.S. debt to $30 trillion, $6 trillion more than the U.S. GDP of $24 trillion. Servicing this debt costs $300 billion a year. Americans spent more on the military, $813 billion for fiscal year 2023, than the next nine countries. Americans are paying a heavy social, political, and economic cost for their militarism. Washington watches passively as the U.S. rots, morally, politically, economically, and physically, while other countries extract themselves from the tyranny of the U.S. dollar and the International Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication, SWIFT, a messaging network banks and other financial institutions use to send and receive information, such as money transfer instructions. Once the U.S. dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency, once there is an alternative to SWIFT, it will precipitate an internal economic collapse. It will force the immediate contraction of the U.S. empire, shuttering most of it, nearly 800 overseas military installations. It will signal the death of Pax Americana. Democrat or Republican, it does not matter. War is the raison d'etre of the state. Extravagant military expenditures are justified in the name of national security. The nearly $40 billion allocated for Ukraine, most of it going into the hands of weapons manufacturers such as Raytheon Technologies, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, BAE Systems, Lockheed Martin, and Boeing, is only the beginning. Military strategists who say the war will be long and protracted are talking about infusions of $4 or $5 billion in military aid a month to Ukraine. Americans face existential threats, but these do not count. The proposed budget for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, in fiscal year 2023 is $10.675 billion. The proposed budget for the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, is $11.881 billion. Ukraine alone gets more than double that amount. Pandemics and the climate emergency are afterthoughts. War is all that matters in the United States of America. This is a recipe for collective suicide. There were three restraints to the avarice and bloodlust of the permanent war economy that no longer exist. The first was the old liberal wing of the Democratic Party, led by politicians such as Senator George McGovern, Senator Eugene McCarthy, and Senator J. William Fulbright, who wrote the Pentagon propaganda machine. The self-identified progressives, a pitiful minority in Congress today, from Barbara Lee, who was the single vote in the House and the Senate opposing a broad, open amended authorization allowing the president to wage war in Afghanistan or anywhere else, to Ilhan Omar now dutifully line up to fund the latest proxy war. The second restraint was on independent media and academia, including journalists such as I.F. Stone and Neil Sheehan, along with scholars such as Seymour Melman, author of The Permanent War Economy and Pentagon Capitalism, The Political Economy of War. Third, and perhaps most important, was an organized anti-war movement led by religious leaders such as Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King Jr., and Phil and Dan Berrigan, as well as groups such as the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. They understood that unchecked militarism was a fatal disease. None of these opposition forces, which did not reverse the permanent war economy but curbed its excesses, now exist. The two ruling parties have been bought by corporations, especially military contractors. The press is anemic and obsequious to the war industry. Propagandists for permanent war, largely from right-wing think tanks lavishly funded by the war industry along with former military and intelligence officials, are exclusively quoted or interviewed as military expats. NBC's Meet the Press aired a segment on May 13th where officials from Center for New American Security, CNAS, simulated what a war with China or Taiwan might look like. The co-founder of CNAS, Michelle Florney, who appeared in the Meet the Press war game segment and was considered by Biden to run the Pentagon, wrote in 2020 in Foreign Affairs that the U.S. needs to develop the capacity and capability to credibly threaten to sink all of China's military vessels, submarines, and merchant ships in the South China Sea within 72 hours, unquote. The handful of anti-militarists and critics of empire from the left, such as Noam Chomsky, and the right, such as Ron Paul, have been declared persona non grata by a compliant media. The liberal class has retreated into boutique activism, where issues of class, capitalism, and militarism are jettisoned for cancel culture, multiculturalism, and identified politics. Liberals are cheerleading the tension and crisis in Ukraine. At least, the inception of the war with Iraq saw them join significant street protests. The new conservatives and liberal interventionists chant in unison for war. Biden has appointed those warmongers whose attitude to nuclear war is terrifyingly cavalier to run the Pentagon, the National Security Council, and the U.S. State Department. Biden has appointed these warmongers whose attitude to nuclear war is terrifyingly cavalier to run the Pentagon, the National Security Council, and the U.S. State Department. Since all people do is war, all proposed solutions are military in the United States. This military adventurism accelerates the decline, the defeat in Vietnam, and the squandering of $8 trillion in futile wars in the West Asia-North Africa region illustrate. War and sanctions, it is believed, will cripple countries rich in gas, oil, and natural resources. War or the threat of war will curb the growing economic and military clout. These are demented and dangerous fantasies perpetrated by a ruling class that has severed itself from reality. No longer able to salvage their own society and economy, they seek to destroy those of their global competitors. Once the militaries cripple countries, the plan goes they will focus military aggression on the Indo-Pacific, dominating what Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, referring to the Pacific, called the American Sea. You cannot talk about war without talking about markets. The United States, whose growth rate has fallen to below 2%, while China's growth rate is 8.1%, has turned to military aggression to bolster its sagging economy.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and here are some thought-provoking words from the Prophet's 16th infallible successor, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, whose martyrdom anniversary we commemorated yesterday, the 25th of Shawwal. The true believers are those who fear God and strive hard so that the guidance they have been provided will not be taken away from them. If they remember God and His grace, they feel apprehensive and fearful. If God's verses are recited before them, this increases their faith and they have complete trust in their Lord.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their offspring.
The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in studio today our speaker, Sister Razia Batul Najafi. She's an Islamic researcher. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
How are you?
Alhamdulillah. With you, I'm always happy and fine. Yeah, definitely.
Thank you. I'm so glad that I provide you some energy. Well, we had been discussing about the responsibilities of parents towards their children. In the previous sessions, we came to know that parents are authorized to give good name to their children. They are authorized to provide them better education. They are authorized to be friends with them, to be frank with them, and to provide the necessary things for their marriage. Well, today I have some other question for you. Who has the responsibility of upbringing a child? Is it just parents? Is it the society or the school? Or does every sphere play some important role in the upbringing of a child?
Oh, well, this is a very profound and very intellectual question. If we all understand that the way our Prophet, he said, kullukum mas'ool, we all of us about each other, because the way we are connecting to each other, we are responsible for each other. Definitely, the amount of responsibility is different, yeah? So, because as a parent, I'm 100%, you know, sometimes connected to my child, and because my child is my blood and flesh and, you know, part of my existence. So, that is not comparable with, definitely, the society. But the way, again, Hadith says that you have three kinds of father. One father is your father who has given birth to you, yeah? Because of him you are all in right. This world, yeah. Number two, the father means the teacher, you mm-hmm. know, the mentor. And number three, the father means a father-in-law, you know.
All right.
So you have three kinds of fathers. Ab has different meanings. So In the society, sometimes, you know, we have so many beautiful stories. A guy from the Abbasi ruler, one of them, or even in Amavi rulers, they, you know, sometimes you can see one of them are so kind and very lover of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
Right.
When you dig the history, you go back to the history, you analyze the history of that person, you will see that, one teacher had, for example, love of Ahlul Bayt and infallibles alayhi salam. Therefore, you know, this person, although he is the son of someone who has killed Imam Hussein al-Islam, for example, or, mm-hmm. you know, some a'imma, but still he has a big heart and, you know, attachment towards Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So why? Because of a, you know, good mentor or a teacher. So no doubt that because we live in a society, yeah, everything nowadays, the social media can be a big, you know, influencer, and we could get, you know, education, and we can change our mindset according even the culture, the lifestyle we are adopting from so many sites and channels and page. And the same thing goes with physical friends and the parents and the teachers
too. All right. So you say that Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, has said that everyone in a society plays a role.
Absolutely.
And that's why man was rightly said to be a social being, because he lives in a society. So in a society, it's the duty of everyone towards the upbringing of a child, not just the parents. Well, sister, I'll be talking to you. Here, we need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I have with me Sister Najafi, who is talking about the responsibility of upbringing a child does that depend particularly on parents or the society or the school, or do all these play some role at some part of life? Sister Najafi, for example, there's a youth and he does not come from a very good background, but he meets a person who is spiritually very, very high. And listening to the sessions of this spiritual personality, listening to the lectures, going to him and meeting him day by day, he feels to a little change. He feels something better. He feels something is really missing in his life. So do you think even friends play some role in the upbringing?
Again, Hadith says, Al-mar'u ma'a dini khalili. Can you believe it? Like a person, yeah, can be judged on the day of judgment according to the deen and the religion and mindset of his or her friend.
All right.
So my friends are somehow, you know, telling Allah or the society and me that what
about
kind
you.
Of, yeah.
All right. So what kind of mentality you carry?
Exactly. And even we have so many ahadith which says that when Israel, the angel of death, will come to capture our soul, that time, again, the friends, they are just in front of us. And if we have a good friends, then we go towards them. They are, somehow they have that power to educate us, to, you know, motivate us towards goodness and to reply the answers, the questions which they are asking. And if we have chosen the bad ones, so the impact of friends are not deniable. Like the impact is very, very powerful. Yeah. No doubt.
All right. You reminded me of one of my incidents. I just met an accident some long time ago. And the moment I met the accident, all of my friends came in front of my eyes. And till now, I never knew why they came in front of my eyes.
Ooh,
and now you
really?
Realized. And now I realized why I had those good friends coming in front of my eyes when I met that accident. I was really near to death that time.
Beautiful.
Well.
And I love this beautiful story of Juwaybir and Zulfa. Like look at the role of a teacher or a prophet or an imam, because unfortunately we don't have ma'sumin in our life nowadays. They are not, you know, apparently we can say appear. So, according to this history, it says that Juwaybir, he was a black guy, black man, and very poor, very simple, but full of faith
and iman.
Yeah. And now Prophet is looking for a partner for him because he was newly converted, you know. And now even I was just coming back from Ottawa and some cities of Canada, and I was engaged with Canadian Muslim, like convertees and revertees, and the biggest problem which they face is that they need someone, you know, a partner, because
right.
Alhamdulillah, they have guided by some friends again in
right.
school, yeah, at teachers, and now they have, you know, welcomed Islam, that now they need some company, and no one is there to
right.
help them. So this is our responsibility, definitely.
All right.
To
So there
support
is
them.
Always this spiritual thirst of knowing things, and friends can really help. Sometimes you can ask all the things to your parents, but sometimes friends can really play some great role. Sister Najafi, I'll be talking to you. Here we need to take another short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat, ya.
The Prophet ﷺ said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. I have with me Sister Najafi, who is saying that Do only parents play a role in Islamic upbringing, or does society and friends also play some role? Sister Najafi, we came to the conclusion that society also plays a role, parents also play a role, and teachers also play a role. Hey, I have a very different question for you. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, apparently did not went to any schools or universities or any other, like, you know, to some academy. He had no scholarly debates in his life. But Imam Ali alayhi salam says that he was guided by the angels. He learned in the school of Allah. So we have so many surahs saying, like, if you read this surah at this particular point of time, these many angels will be descended from the sky. They will be protecting you. Can we ask Allah to guide us through angels, or like, can we ask for some spiritual guide, a spiritual upbringing from the, like, some help from the angels and Allah?
Okay, beautiful question. Yeah. I usually say nowadays, especially the duty of mothers and fathers, sada, nida, dua, yeah, you know, sometimes, especially mothers, they just stuck in some area. They say, what can I do? You know, the only way is to have some support and some connection from unseen world.
True.
So dua, nida, whispering, munajat, and total rely on the invisible powers which Allah has given to us. Because of that, we are human beings. So that would be the wonderful, the most crucial, you know, way of upbringing. We need it. And that is fundamental, like really, really, really necessary that we should have that connection. Because, you know, we are feeding ourselves by connecting to angels and Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala. Then we can feed and then we can share that energy with our children.
True.
And when we are talking about the important role of friends in upbringing of children, that means parents, they should be very, very careful about the environment which mm-hmm. they are creating. Because as a father, I'm choosing the city and the country and the school, for example, and the place to live and the neighbors to live. Yeah,
but you cannot change the mindset of the friends.
Yeah.
So you have to be, as a parent, you are trying to say, you have to be very careful.
Very careful, very careful. So it's not like that, oh yeah, no. Because in my family, never ever this kind of sins happened. So my child never can do this.
You have to be a supervision kind of thing. Exactly. You have to do a supervision kind of thing all the time. You have to be a supervisor, you're trying to say.
No doubt.
All right. So you have to supervise things. You said, like, definitely we need some spiritual guides as well in Islamic upbringing, and we can get them through du'as, through supplications.
Yeah, I will suggest Sahif al-Sajjadiyah, du'a number 25.
All right. Thank you so much for suggesting such a beautiful dua towards the end of the session. Thank you so much, sister, for getting the time and coming to the studio.
You're most welcome.
Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. For any suggestions, for any questions, for any feedback, please email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can find us on social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. Our website is parstoday.com, wherein you can find all our programs. Going to the option Call of Islam and you'll find our programs. Until another episode, fi amanallah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
The world's oldest living man has just turned 113 years and says he is going to be around at least 10 more years. Good for him. Born on May the 27th, 1909 in Venezuela, Juan Vicente Perez Mora is still in pink of his health and memory and does not take medication. He has no trouble recalling his childhood marriage and the names of his siblings, children, and grandchildren. He has 41 grandchildren, by the way. So what is the secret behind a long life? Work hard, rest on holidays, go to bed early, love for God, and always carry him in your heart. The Guinness World Records declared Perez Mora the oldest living person last week. The meadows in the foothills of the Swiss Alps have turned white these days, with locals calling it May snow. But it has nothing to do with snow. It's all about narcissus blooms covering the hills above the town of Montreux. Locals call the scene May snow because it looks like a blanket of snow from a distance. The flowers have been a tourist attraction since the 19th century, but factors such as urbanization have caused their decline in the past few years. Humans have disrupted the turtle survival for years due to their greed for meat, eggs, skin, and shells. But the decreasing population of the species is creating conscience of conservation. Cambodians have released hundreds of turtles of an endangered variety into the wild on World Turtle Day. About 600 Cantor's giant soft-shell turtles were let into a river in northeastern Cambodia. After people collected the species from a holding pool, Cambodian monks blessed the tiny creatures, then set them free. The Wildlife Conservation Society was the organizer of this event. It said that only a few records of Cantor turtles have remained in Laos, while they have mostly been wiped out in Vietnam and Thailand. The body has so far released over 1,500 hatchlings into the wild in 2022. Artists in a small town in the United Kingdom have created a massive bumblebee mural, hoping to raise awareness about this vanishing species. The mural was painted on the playing field of a primary school in the town of Haptonbridge. It was debuted on International Bee Day. The artist used paints typically used to draw lines for football pitches. Scientists say rising temperatures and heavy pesticide use are contributing to the decline in the number of bumblebees across Europe and North America. They say the population reduction rate is consistent with mass extinction of a species altogether. Children at a school have also created a wildflower meadow to help encourage bees to pollinate. A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's wood blocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of a thick sheet of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. Then ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge is 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtanaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Youssef Jalali from Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from their hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400 square meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future. Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South